Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Gem Pursuit. My name is Matthew Weldon, and I'm joined in our magical and mysterious pursuit through the world of antique and vintage jewellery by my trusty co-host, Elise Ketcher. Hello, Elise.
Hello, everyone. The trustiest there ever was.
That is for sure. This week, we are going to look at one of the most collectible areas of antique jewellery. This style of antique jewellery represents the connection between jewellery and the suffragettes, who were the pioneering activists for women's right to vote during the early 20th century. So let's go.
All right, Matthew, let's see how good you are with the history of the suffragette movement.
Well, you know, Elise, the first thing I'd like to point out here, you know, it was, you know, the right to vote for women. Obviously, in Ireland today, it's such an alien concept, you know, that women couldn't vote. But here's a quick bit of trivia for you. And I think you might know the answer to this now. But which country in the world gave women the right to vote first?
I'm pretty sure it was New Zealand, Matthew.
It was your hometown, New Zealand. Exactly. That's correct. Yeah. And that was in 1893.
Yes.
So I think that's pretty cool. And, you know,
I mean, I think it is cool, but like also imagine in the 1990s, which wasn't one very long ago, that was only 100 years before that we had the right to vote. And we've been contributing to society a lot longer than 100 years ago, let me tell you that.
Yeah, I think so. But when you say 100 years, right, that sounds like, sometimes you say, you're like, oh, it's 100 years, it's a long time. Although, you know, getting older, I can start to comprehend how long that is. But if you think of it, I always think of it as like my mother's grandmother was from then. Like, you know what I mean? It's pretty close when you think of generations, but when you think of 100 years, it sounds like it could have been a long time ago, but it's really like pretty close. Like, you know, people for sure who would have known someone from that era. So it's pretty close.
Yes. So first off, what I want to explain is what is suffrage? Okay. Suffrage is the right to vote in parliamentary and general elections. The fight for female suffrage across the world has its own history according to each country, right? So, of course, we've just spoken about New Zealand. New Zealand was the first country to allow women to vote. We also have like the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in the US, which was voted in on August 18, 1920. So that's when, you know, it happened in the US. We also have the Commonwealth Franchise Act that happened in 1902, which allowed women in Australia to vote. But all over the world, women's rights to vote has its own history. So I want to honor that in this particular episode and let people know that, yes, we recognize that in some countries in the world, even today, women's suffrage is not where we want it to be and they don't have the right to vote. And it's definitely not a fight that has been won everywhere. But what this particular episode is about women's fight for suffrage in the UK in particular. So
because it's linked to the suffragette jewellery.
Yes, because it's linked to the jewellery. So although we understand that it's not a fight that has been won everywhere and it's still something that's ongoing, this particular episode is about the history of the UK fight for women's suffrage. And it was donned as the suffragette movement, which I thought was quite a sweet way to feminize the word as well, and also to put a name to this particular fight. And its history in the UK was famously started by a Manchester woman named Emmeline Pankhurst, who I will talk about later. But she founded the Social and Political Union, the Women's Social and Political Union in 1903. And this is really where things start to progress. So for short, they were known as the WSPU. 1903 is when they started, and their aim was to wake up the nation and to gain women's suffrage through deeds, not words. So that was their particular headline, deeds, not words. Now, this particular suffragette movement was also militant. So we have not only protests that happen, but we also have, you know, the breaking of glass. We also had a very, very famous painting called The Toilet of Venus, which was wounded, as they said. Seven wounds were placed along the body of Venus, the goddess, on this particular painting as a direct result of one of the suffragettes being imprisoned. And, you know, numerous other, I would say, what are considered rebellious acts, even today, antisocial behavior from the suffragettes to try and win this fight throughout the early 1900s. So it's very, very interesting. It's very foreign to us today because it is a fight that we currently enjoy the after effects of and don't give it much thought today when we go to the voting polls and elections, but had a very grisly beginning, I would say.
Yeah, if certain approaches weren't working, you had to, you know, in a movement, you have to resort to kind of other movements. But the suffragette movement in the UK, you know, and this is where I think jewellery becomes a really perfect medium for it, is it was largely like an upper class movement. And the rebellious acts, you know, there was, at one stage, there was over 1,000 suffragettes in prison at one stage, which is a pretty large amount of people for one particular movement. But ultimately, to convince, I think, you know, upper class women of Britain at that time, the violent approach probably didn't work as well as it could have. But that's why jewellery was so perfect, because these ladies loved wearing jewellery. And it also became a bit of an icon to support the suffragette movement.
I agree in some aspects. I know that we also have to link this into the period that was. So during this particular, you know, 1903 is when it begins, you know, when the suffragettes kind of gain a name for themselves and kind of start to recruit. Now, they really did see this as a war, right? They saw this as a civil war that was taking place. And Emmeline Pankhurst even sells her home, goes to the US and goes on campaign to get money from other women in the US for this civil war, which she believes is taking place in the UK for her right to vote. Now, this is passion, right? This is extreme passion for the cause. And how were they treated by the government? Well, the suffragettes were thrown into Holloway Prison in North London because they were protesting and also committing other militant acts. And then they wanted to be treated like political prisoners when they were in Holloway jail Holloway Prison. Now, the government refused to recognize them as political prisoners. So the women went on hunger strike. Now, when I say they were serious, like, I love my food, honestly. Like, it wouldn't work for me. No, the seriousness of this is the truth. Like, I just wouldn't work for me.
I think a hunger strike, though, in any context is like the ultimate statement you can make as commitment. Like, you are literally willing to die.
But the thing is that the government even rebel against this for the women. So they start force feeding them. They stick tubes down their necks. They hold them in prison cells as they force feed these women. Now, if you go to, the Museum of London is currently closed, but the Museum of London Docklands in the UK, in London, they have the collection that the Museum of London usually have. I know that's a mouthful, but if you look it up, you'll be able to go and see their collection. They have photographs of women being force fed. And let me tell you, it is brutal. It is, to me, it is an absolute form of torture. And the fact that these women were willing to give up their homes, were willing to give up their status in society, were willing to give up everything, including their lives, for their right to vote, is incredible. Now, because of the fact that the force feeding wasn't even working, because the government, you know, even force feeding the women wasn't happening, the British government decided to then pass an act. Now, the suffragettes named it the Cat and Mouse Act, right? So what the government did was they were like, okay, you're not going to eat. As soon as you get too weak to protest from not eating in prison, we're going to release you. So we'll release you back out. And then once we see that you get better again, if we see you marching again, we're going to rearrest you. So they try to find a way around this hunger striking so that no one's going to die on their watch. But also, we're not going to allow you to get better, well enough for you to be able to protest. You think about that, it's just, it is so damaging, not only to your body, but to your mental health, you know, something like that happening to you. And it was for a cause. Like, this is the history of the suffragette movement. That's why I wanted to really kind of give an in-depth insight into what the next part is, which is the style of the era. But these women were serious. Like, we're talking about a real serious fight, something that they felt extremely passionate about. And just to end this off, you know, they didn't actually win the fight, right? So all the way up until 1918, the women are doing this, and then the war happens. And what do? They put all of their efforts into supporting the country for the war. And that just goes to show you that they were actually ready to be a part of the country. They wanted to have an active say in what was happening because they were passionate about the policies and the politics that were affecting their everyday lives. And they deserved the vote, and they got the vote later on after obviously contributing during World War I. But the fact that they were willing to go to these extreme lengths to gain their rights is very inspiring, and of course inspired not only that movement, but a jewelry movement as well. So we're talking about the style of the suffragettes. There's probably one movie that you've never thought about, that you've probably seen, that does have a huge part of it that is dedicated to suffragettes. Now, it is a child's movie.
Now, you know I don't watch a lot of movies.
I know, so. But it's a child's movie. It has a song for the suffragettes in it.
Oh, George, give me a verse there of it. Maybe I recognize it.
Well done, sister suffragettes. He's like, no. Anyway. Well, you might know this song verse is from the same thing, but it's not from that song. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Okay, yeah. I don't know, but I just Googled it though. So that's...
So what is it?
It's Mary Poppins.
Yes. So if any of you out there have watched the original Mary Poppins, you will notice that the mother in Mary Poppins actually needs a nanny because she is an active suffragette. So she has to be away from the home to go to protests. And she even talks about one of her sisters getting locked up because she ties herself to a carriage wheel of the prime minister. And she wears a sash that says votes for women. So cool. Such a great thing to expose children to as well. But one thing that I want to say about her in particular is that as a child, I remember watching it and thinking, she's so glamorous. She's so beautiful. Like, her hair looks great. What she's wearing is beautiful. And she's extremely feminine. Now, the style of the suffragettes. Emmeline Pankhurst was the head honcho, basically. Head honcho, you go to Emmeline Pankhurst. Yes, but she's the mama. She's the mama of the Pankhurst clan. And she recognized that in the papers, when they were talking about the suffragettes, they were talking about them as if they were unladylike, boorish, an attack on their femininity, let's say. Nobody wants to be with them because they're marching and they're unladylike women. Emmeline Pankhurst recognized this. And she said to the women of the suffragette movement, when we march in our best dress. I want to see hats. I want all of the elegance and femininity of the Edwardian era to be on display so that they couldn't attack the women's femininity. So this particular movement is extremely pretty. The suffragette pieces that you see, how would you describe them, Matthew?
Yes, pretty period. Edwardian jewelry. It is during this time period. So it weaves into what you expect from Edwardian jewelry. You know, the pretty period, the Belle Epoque, if you're in France. So you've got very fine work, very elegant, understated, demure garlands, extremely pretty. But I think the key factor for a suffragette piece of jewelry comes down to the colors, really. And you're probably asking the colors of gemstones. And now let's try and remember that at this time, the gemstones in jewelry were often used to convey meaning. Just before that, in the Victorian period, you've got acrostic jewelry where, you know, it's spelled out a hidden meaning. The suffragette jewelry, they can have a whole variety of stones, but they always have the same colors. It's a green, it's a white, and a violet. And it's, the first letter of each of those words, G, W, V, and give women votes. So what you'll see, when I think of it anyway, it's usually, the green is normally peridot, the white is usually pearl or diamond, and the violet is typically amethyst. Other stones you will see though, you'll see tourmalines, you can see white enamel for the white color.
Or even green enamel I've seen, or emerald.
I've never seen an emerald one actually. That would be a rare thing, I think.
And a demantoid garnet.
Yes. I've seen demantoid garnet ones. Funny enough, it's super collectible, right? Because, I mean, there's not loads of this jewelry out there. It's quite rare. But I remember we had a gold curb-link bracelet that had cabochon, amethyst and peridots and pearls in it. And we just got it. I think we posted on Instagram, we sold it straight away and we like took a tiny profit on it. They were like, oh yeah, in this business, you're like, oh, if you can sell it quickly, you'll just turn it, right? And I remember thinking to myself, oh, that was great. And then, you know, that was about, that must have been 6 or 7 years ago. And I don't think I've seen anything even remotely close since. But I think that's what you're going to see. So you're in, that's in terms of the stones, right? The color is a key. In terms of the design, typically what you're going to see, you know, it's typical Edwardian style jewelry. So it's light, it's open, it's fine jewelry. So whereas Victorian pieces tend to be quite heavy. Now, there are some specific pieces which are quite famous, you know, and actually, you know, we'll come to those in our icon piece, I believe. But one thing that is really interesting about what you see about these colors in jewelry became so popular that actually they just got woven into normal Edwardian jewelry anyway.
Yeah, they didn't actually realize what it was representing. Emmeline Petthink Lawrence, which was the business manager of the WPSU and also the editor for the Votes for Women newspaper, was the one who actually chose the colors. And she only chose the colors in 1908. So 1903 is when the actual movement began, or the WPSU started. But she herself, this is a quote from her, and she says, "Purple, as everyone knows, is the royal color. It stands for the royal blood that flows in the veins of every suffragette. The instinct of freedom and dignity. White stands for purity in public and private life. Green is the color of hope and an emblem of spring." So the colors were very well thought out as a way of showing, number one, a lot of the suffragettes, as you stated previously, came from noble lineage, had status in society. So the purple representing that. And then white showing that they were pure indeed and thought in terms of what they were looking for. And then lastly, green, which represented hopefully a new beginning, which would allow them to vote or have a say in how their everyday life was going to be. And those particular colors are so intertwined with this movement that every time they marched, the sashes that they wore, even when we today see those three colors, we automatically think that's a suffragette piece. But then we have to look at whether or not the style fits in with the time period that this particular movement happened in. But those colors are now doing exactly what she wanted, bringing us straight back to this movement and are synonymous with their fight. And, you know, of course, for them, I'm pretty sure that they would be extremely proud to know that their sacrifice is still recognized in such a beautiful way today.
Yes, certainly, for sure. And one interesting thing is you mentioned there, it just struck me, the, you know, the colors were only picked in 1908. Now some of these pieces are definitely earlier than that. So yeah, they say that, you know, true suffragette jewelry is the 7 years before World War One then. But it's interesting that it definitely became a category, because in 1909, Mappin and Webb, a big jewelry company, actually had a suffragette like page or whatever in their catalog.
Yes.
So it did become a piece. But as I said, now, if it's from that time period, and it's got those colors, we consider it suffragette jewelry. So still to come, we are going to talk about our two icons of the suffragette era. But first, we have a very unique piece related to the suffragettes, which we've just added to our Instagram. Elise, can you tell us a little bit about it?
This is such a great way to show off suffragette piece, because lo and behold, we have one of the most prettiest necklaces that you can ever imagine, which has come straight out of this era. Now, It can be found on our Instagram. The link for it is in our show notes. If you want to see it on our website, the code for it is JUN21007A. This particular piece is done typically in the Edwardian fashion. It features green, white, and violet, which are, of course, the three colors of the suffragette movement. The green in it is peridot, the white in it is seed pearls, and the violet in it is amethyst. This particular pendant features exactly what you would expect from the Edwardian period. Gorgeous garland motifs, linear open work in gold, fabulous handcrafted chain, and such gorgeous settings for the gemstones, and they really do stand out in this particular piece. If you're looking for a suffragette piece with the acrostic message, give women votes, we have a few pieces of this particular jewelry, but this is definitely a standout.
And I love, like, yeah, the colors of the stones, and like, it actually almost looks a little bit like the
Pancurst.
Yeah, it looks
the
like
the drawbridge.
The drawbridge. It has that kind of linear grate, the kind of prison feel to it almost. And it's a beautiful one if you're interested in getting a suffragette piece of jewelry. Trade tip, Elise. What is your trade tip for suffragette jewelry for someone who's interested in collecting this very sought after type of jewelry? What would you say to them?
What I would say, look at the materials that the suffragette pieces have been created in. So I've seen suffragette pieces, badges, all the way from silver arts and crafts pieces to Art Nouveau style-esque pieces to high Edwardian pieces. I have never seen a suffragette piece in platinum. So I've seen it in silver. I've seen it in gold. I've seen elements of settings that might have a small amount of platinum in it, but I've never seen a full platinum suffragette piece. So that would be my trade tip for you, is if you're looking at a suffragette piece, it wants to be in the arts and crafts style, Art Nouveau style, or Edwardian style, and yellow, gold, or silver.
Yeah, I've never thought about that, but actually any of the ones that we've had have been gold or silver and gold. Great tip. But my trade tip for this one would be, as you said, you know, the suffragette movement was obviously across the board, but, you know, a lot of upper class ladies involved with it, and men, of course. But at that time, those circles were quite small internationally as well. So, you know, these ladies would have traveled from one place to the next. So suffragette pieces do pop up in other places, and they make it, they are extremely rare. There is evidence of a Russian suffragette movement. There is evidence of a French one. So there's, you do get these pieces from other places, and that really adds another layer to the rarity and the desirability. And we actually have one, believe it or not. We have a Russian piece from the time period set with amethyst, peridot, and diamond. Very typical Art Nouveau. It's completely asymmetric.
With a whiplash, whiplash, whiplash.
Yes. And if you haven't listened to it, if you can listen to our previous episode, we'll give you all the details about Art Nouveau. But this Russian suffragette piece, it's got the right time period, the right stones, and I'm pretty sure that is an original Russian one. And if you come across a suffragette piece from a different country other than England, it just adds another layer to its rarity and desirability. Icons of the suffragette movement. Elise, who are you going with today?
Well, we can't talk about the suffragette movement in the UK without talking about the Pankhurst family. Now, I've already touched on the mama, Emmeline Pankhurst, you know, the founder of the WSPU. But she had some daughters. And, you know, in typical fashion, when a mother is passionate about a cause, it usually ends up with the daughters being quite passionate as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Sylvia Pankhurst, who is one of Emmeline's daughters. She had three daughters. And I'm just going to quickly talk about, you know, how she contributed to this particular movement. Now, I'd have to say that, you know, it would be pretty difficult to be the daughter of Emmeline because you're a child or a teenager and, you know, your mum's out there marching for the right to vote and, you know, there's a lot of opposition against this and a lot of people saying, you know, why are you fighting for a vote anyway? It will make no difference. And why are you, you know, questioning the status quo, basically?
Well, kids just want to fit in, so...
Yeah, but also the mum selling the house, you know.
Well, that's unsettling.
Yeah, exactly. The mum selling the house for this cause and the daughters are jumping on board. Now, I can imagine there was probably some pushback that we don't know about historically, but the daughters jump on board. Remembering as well that if you can remember back to when you were a child, like my mum's best friends were like aunties to me. I saw them all the time. My mum was always visiting with them. You'd go over to your mum's friend's house and, you know, play with her kids and stuff like that. So Sylvia's life would have been disrupted by not only her mother being imprisoned, but a lot of her mother's friends who would have been very close to her as well. Okay. So it's turbulent. It's a turbulent upbringing. But Sylvia actually designs a brooch. And this particular brooch, it's now referred to as the Holloway Prison Brooch. And she actually created these brooches and they were given to suffragettes who were incarcerated at Holloway Prison, you know, as kind of like a badge of honor to go, you know, you went into Holloway Prison and for the cause. And this was Sylvia's way of kind of showing, I'd say, her love and how proud she was of what her extended family, so to say, were doing. Now, the brooch itself depicted the portcullis. It was a symbol of the House of Commons. And it had in the center of it a broad arrow, which is the convict symbol. And that particular broad arrow was in purple, white, and green enamel. And then it was hanging from chains. So it was very symbolic of showing kind of like, you know, the House of Commons were making these women convicts and chaining them up. And the women would wear these brooches very proudly. And I think it's a really great way to kind of show that Sylvia, Emmeline's daughter, was really also behind the cause, even though it was a very fine line that Emmeline was peddling, that the daughters could have gone either way. And I think this really shows how much the family were together on this particular fight and this particular movement.
Yeah, I think it would have been difficult, but as you said, they definitely were
Believers.
And for anyone trying to picture this brooch, we'll put a link to it in the notes. But portcullis is, for some reason, I think of Game of Thrones when I see the picture of what this looks like. It's like where there's a drawbridge behind, and there's a big archway behind it. And it's got like a grate, like a big steel grate. And it's got a spiky bottom. So, you know, in a film when like the gate shuts on the drawbridge, that's like a portcullis. And that this brooch was like that. But I'm looking at that brooch as well. Yeah, really cool. It actually stands out. Kind of doesn't actually look typically Edwardian to me, really.
No, it looks almost like, I would say, a military badge. I think it's supposed to look a little bit like a military badge.
Well, this was a war, as you said. Yeah. So they'd have a military badge. So,
and done through jewelry. So love the Pankhurst family for that. Great.
Well, I have, and my icon today is someone who was a suffragette, of course, but this lady was also a jeweler, and she also had a very unusual upbringing for the particular time period. And also, what's really cool about her is that three pieces designed by this lady can still be seen today in the Museum of London, which is said is temporarily closed, but can be seen in...
the Museum of London Docklands.
Perfect. So the lady I'm going to talk about is someone called Ernestine Evan Mills. She was English, born 1871. What was really cool about this lady, she was actually a metal worker and an enameler, which I think are a really cool thing because, you know, enamelers today are so hard to find. And at that time, she was doing that along with the jewelry. So a really rare combination of skills to actually get any time, but especially then. She's born in Hastings in England. And the reason she had an interesting upbringing is that her mother was a musician and an actor, and her father was a writer. So came from like a really creative background, like the arts in the house would have been a big thing. She was actually educated at home and then at Notting Hill School for Girls, and she had a very clear talent for drawing, which is evident actually from a very young age. So obviously the design element of her skill set.
She's a creative.
Now she joined, in 1907, she actually joined Emmeline Pankhurst's WSPU, where she was really well known because there was an iconic photo at the time of a lady who, on what was called Black Friday, which is not what Black Friday is known as today. Let me tell you, but Black Friday in 1910, it was the 19 November 1910. There was a picture from Black Friday on the 19th November 1910 in the Daily Mirror. And there was violent scenes at Westminster where, you know, a lot of suffragettes were arrested while trying to force their way into the House of Commons. And this was on the 18th, and on the 19th, the photo was in the paper. But there's one, this famous picture is of a suffragette on the ground. Looks like, you know, she's been assaulted or attacked by a member of police. There's kind of people around, you know, it looks like complete pandemonium. Now, this lady on the ground hasn't been identified 100%, but it's generally accepted that it was Ernestine Evans Mills in this photo. So she was pretty hardcore in terms of her support for the WSPU, but also actually created the jewelry, the suffragette jewelry, which was linked to this movement as well. So also she was a member of the Soroptimus Society and the Greater London Club, which is also pretty cool because last year we actually did a fair. The Soroptimus International had their convention, their annual convention, the worldwide one in Dublin last year, and we actually had a stand at that. And funny enough, we actually sold a piece of suffragette jewellery. But no, she was involved in that as well. She actually lived to the age 88, which was 1959. So she would have seen the entire movement. And as I said, three of her pieces can still be seen today.
I love that she actually had the chance to see women have the right to vote and be able to participate in the development of her own country. I think that's such a full circle moment for her. So I think that's the fruit of her labor. She got to see, you know, she planted the seed and she got to actually see fruit come from the tree. And I think that is a really beautiful full circle moment.
Well, thank you very much for listening today. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to the podcast, and we'd love to hear any feedback that you have. So if you do have anything you'd like to let us know, you can get us on Instagram at Courtville Antiques. Or you can email us at experts@courtville.ie, and we would genuinely love to hear from you. So don't hesitate to get in touch. And once again, we really appreciate you taking the time to listen to our podcast. That said, we are going to wrap it up today. I'd have to thank, of course, my most trusty of trusty co-hosts, Elise Ketcher. Thank you, Elise.
Thank Give women votes. Thank you.
And of course, our podcast producer, dustpod.io, who makes us sound fantastic. Thank you very much, Dusty and Aoife. So until the next time, from me, Matthew Weldon, see you all very, very soon.